Now, Carl Stuba, now he drove out a whole lot of kids out of here, you know, that, at that time. There wasn't that many, you know.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, he had for years, you know, and he kept the car. And they still got it over there, but they were, I was junked out of middle of Mike at eight, you know. Mm-hmm. And so, Carl, I gave him all the windows out of that. I don't know whether he paid me for them or not, but anyway, I don't know whether it was a deal that way. But anyway, he ended up with the windows, and they were having the auction after Carl died.
Mm-hmm.
Over at the house over there, you know, and here was this pile of glass laying there, and I took a look at it, and I said, well, no, I think that's it. I said, have you still got that Suburban, mate? And they said, yeah. I said, well, these are the spare windows for it.
Oh,
and
wow.
And they bought the auction them off, and they had one broken window in it, and I said, oh, God, there's the window
for
it, you know.
I didn't know they still had that Suburban. This is the one he started with, mm-hmm.
No,
is what you're saying? Oh,
and
my
and
gosh.
That was the first Chevy I ever saw that had had an automatic transmission.
Hmm.
And that was the old hydromatic.
Hmm.
And
now, what year would that have been?
Well, that was about 51.
Must have been. You first came and homesteaded out here?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it was a pretty new rig then, so it may have been a 49 or something. That whole era was all about the same, you know.
So, is that when he started his school bus?
No, that was a 60. That was a 1950, the first year of that body style.
But he started driving kids.
No, that was the earlier body style. That's right. That was because that had to be a 48 or 49 model. 49. 49 was the body style. I can remember that part. I can remember Chevy trucks. What years they changed body style, and then it changed fancy stuff down in the road years. But then the basic car was the same.
Did you ever have to pull the school bus out of the ditch or anything?
I think the only time I ever did that, we had a washout right there at my place across the road.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I pulled it through there when
Mom,
they were building the road out there. And I don't remember who's. It had to be a Carl's bus because he was the one that had the coffee.
You want anything in your coffee?
Sugar, yeah.
Sure.
Two heaping teaspoons.
Well, why don't you put it in your sock?
All right.
Keep in mind, this is more than a teaspoon.
Oh, yeah.
Are we going to gamble on that map, or?
Maybe we should roll it up.
Well, I don't think we want to.
Oh, well, Bob's done smoking, so we can just move that.
Yeah. Put that on the table.
Yeah. Let's just slide it back a little bit and get it moving for his
cup. Yeah.
Maybe that was positive. We can adjust.
No,
there you go. That is hot, and here's the sugar.
When I was running the analytics department, they had that big forest fire out there around the North Hill Homestead and all that. We went all the way across this whole flat out here.
Oh, wow.
And I took our 2,000-gallon tanker, and right there on North Hill Road, they had it on the bridge.
Mm-hmm.
We had a pump sitting down there that we could refill the tanker, and I went up along. They had a bunch of subdivision roads. Back in here,
mm-hmm.
and I was able to get on those old road beds and run through there, and I wet all that down. I saved all those houses north and east of the road.
Wow!
I saved all those houses.
Along
Badger Road. And that was it. What I used to do on the volunteer fire department, all my people, we'd go fight fires anywhere as long as we could get there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we followed Badger Road and all kinds of places, and it saved quite a few houses out there. Now they have these territories. We had territory too, but what I used to call them training.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the more fires you fight, the more you know about it.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
And so
exactly.
I had an extremely well trained bunch of volunteers over there.
Mm-hmm.
Enough, I think.
You got your two in?
Yeah, we get that out of the way.
Yeah, that's a big spoon.
No, it's a sugar spoon. Sugar spoon. Sugar shell, I think we call
them. So what do you remember about Carl Herning?
Oh, quite a bit.
What are some stories you can tell us about Carl?
Well, he was running that one bunch of Jimmy buses he had, and he kept cracking heads.
Oh, on the engine? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so he was getting heads from us. I was working for helping Bobby Miller at that time, and so we had a bunch of serious engines, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he kept cracking his head, and finally I went up and looked at him, what in the heck are you doing? What's going on? Because the 302 Jimmy was not famous for cracking heads.
Mm-hmm.
And what's going on out here? And so I took a look at it, and I says, well, you know, the old World War II 6x, which is a 270, which is almost the same engine, had a line that went to the back of the head. And it's when Carl was climbing these steep hills out here,
mm-hmm.
the engine would go dry, and then going down there, go dry on the other end, and get all he did was he did what I told him, and he put that line in the back of the nose and never cracked another head.
Oh, so it was an oil line.
It's a water line in the coolant system.
Oh, okay.
And kept the head all wet both ways, because it arched up quite a bit and went clear to the top of the radiator, so it was quite a drop there, so it would keep water in it all the way.
Mm-hmm. Very good.
Do you remember our first mail carrier? Martha Markey?
Oh, you did.
Have you read her book? She wrote a book about that.
No, I haven't, but she'd break down, and invariably when she'd break down and whatever would go wrong, we'd be up close to my place, and so I'd go out, we'd load over and load in my car, and we'd go out and take out and finish the route, and then go back, and she'd call her husband, Bob, she'd call Bob up, and Bob would come out and fix the truck or jury rig enough to get it back home and fix it. What is that old Dodge panel?
Right. Well, you'd enjoy her book, because she tells all about these things that happen.
Am I mentioned in there? I might be.
You might have been, because there were a lot of familiar names.
I saw her. It hadn't been for 3 or 4 years. She came up, do you remember me? And quite frankly, I didn't, you know. And then she said, I'm Martha.
Oh, yeah,
then bang, I got she looked familiar, but I couldn't remember her name, you know. Of course, I've never been good on names.
Yeah.
One of the few names I ever remember is the guy who was in the service when I was still doing paperwork. And that's when George Lyle was in the outfit, you know. And his name was Midzebrocky. And I sat down and looked at that, like, how will I ever remember that? Just spell that name. It's Midzebrocki. I can remember that. But it was the extra effort I had to remember. I had to do to remember.
Yeah,
his name,
this
you know?
Is the first place.
Now, we used to have a lot of fun with George and Ann both when they'd call on the phone, you know.
That wasn't the, what phone were they calling on?
Well, they called in on the old, you know, East 8 Never Late type phone, you know.
Right.
Well, the base had dial system.
Uh-huh.
But they'd have to call into the base, and then they'd get it to the squadron, and the squadron had that crank phone which we could tie into the system. So if you wanted to call anybody at 6 mile, you had to come through the squadron and then go out there.
I see, because there certainly weren't any phones out here.
And there was a guy named Fox who was a company commander at that time, early on, and then later on, Mayenfelder was the second one, and he was still there when George got discharged. But I didn't know that George had been overseas in the Second World War.
I don't think he mentioned that in his interview.
Well, he was.
Yeah, that was news when they had the memorial service.
Yeah.
In Germany? Or where overseas?
I think
Normandy. I think he landed, he was in a some kind of equipment.
He was Navy first, remember. He was Navy and then he went with Army Air Force. But he got into the Air Force after the war.
Okay, so he was.
But he was doing, he was on the ships.
Yeah, well, that's, somebody had said that, maybe it was Bob or Jim, said that he, when they had the Normandy invasion.
Yeah, he was on the ships out there.
Yeah, and so the Marines or whatever they were called at the time, they all went in and got killed and everything, and George's equipment battalion or something followed them in with.
Yeah, he, I think he was in the Seabees, I think. You know.
Yeah,
yeah,
for the construction. And I never had known.
No, that's all news to me. He sure didn't go into any of that.
But I didn't know that either, and I didn't realize George was that much older. Of course, he was 86, was he?
Yeah.
So he was 6 years older than him, and I just barely missed the Second World War.
Oh.
Yeah, he and Al were pretty much of an age.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then he was just a few years younger than Carl. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And Walt did India, you know.
Oh, yeah, we heard quite a bit about
that. He was flying the hump over there.
Mm-hmm.
not flying. They have to do the maintenance.
No, but he was keeping the airplanes flying.
Yeah. That always tickled me when he was rebuilding that wing for the old UC-78.
down in his garage.
I was raised as a kid in Wichita where those were built.
Oh.
And I watched all those take off, and they were building the B-29 there. And I was working for Boeing at that time. All the kids in high school that had more than 2 years of drafting, Boeing hired us as junior draftsmen.
Wow.
And I worked on that, and of course, when you're drafting, you know everything. It was kind of funny. I went back after I got out of the service. I went back for a few months. I'd already changed my resident address for here.
Mm-hmm.
The Army shipped me back to where I first enlisted.
They always do that.
They were supposed to let me out right here.
Oh.
But anyway, they shipped me down here. So I went to work for Boeing for a while, and we were on the B-47 program. And before you go into the program, when you're new hires, or even rehires, you had to go through boot break class and sheet metal class.
Mm-hmm.
And back as a kid there, I also owned the old cafe at the old Swallow Field in Wichita. And my sister was supposed to run that, and she and her husband screwed up, and finally we ran him off, and she and I ran it. But I did work on the airplanes and stuff. So right after the war, we were modifying a bunch of airplanes, surplus, modifying them into commercial types, R.C. Allman and Company, and so I was over there, and that's where I first really learned to do aircraft repair. And I go back out there, and I walk to the boot break class and opened up this. It's a training print, and I'm looking at that, and I looked at that, and I folded it up and laid it down. This guy that's running the class, he come up, somebody think you know all about that? I got no about as much about that plane as anybody alive. And he said, how's that? And I said, well, see down in the corner? That's my initial. I've drawn the print. Then we went into sheet metal, and I walked into Chile. His name is Chillicott. And Chile was running that class. And the first year that he ever drove, I showed him how.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah, what are you doing in here? And I said, well, man, so I helped teach both those classes. And then they gave me a whole department at Boeing. I did pick up. And anyone who passed the Air Force's inspection has to be sent to pick up to repair it, and get bringing in the line. And then later on, I was up here before they brought the first one in for B-47. I got out. I quit down there, and I came home, came home, as a matter of fact. And I was working in a power plant, and I heard this airplane. That's a B-47. And I ran out of the place. And that was after the fire in the power plant. And they had me up there. All I was doing was watching for fire in the place.
Mm-hmm.
And so I ran down to the flight line. And of course, the MPs are all around this airplane and all this kind of junk, The guys flying the airplane were good buddies of mine that had known in Wichita, they were the guys flying the airplane. And so I walked down there, and I started walking by the airplane, the MPs. I just started walking by it, And they were stopping me, and these guys, they saw me over there, and they come over, Bob, how you doing? This kind of stuff. Then I come back up here, this MP was like, well, he can't go in there. And they said, well, why not? He knows as much about these damn airplanes as we do. I said, well, he used to work Boeing, I did that for about a month and a half, and I quit. I had to go home. Yeah, I came back on December the 23rd.
Go back up here.
I came home.
Your new home.
Yeah, I had my cabin and everything else. Mm-hmm. That was funny. I was fire chief up on the D line. I was senior fire chief on the whole D line up there for 2 years, and had a VIP deal coming up there.
Uh-huh.
This little white-haired guy, he comes out there, and we're sitting there talking, and I had soda pop out there. They give us a beer ration. They give you one case of beer a week, or you get 2 cases of soda pop. Well, it meant my job, I couldn't drink the beer, so I traded off the other guys, so I had soda pop, really, really heavy. And anyway, so I was giving these guys that came out, the VIPs, I was giving them sort of, I didn't introduce myself, you know. Mm-hmm. We got to talk to this little white-haired guy, and we got over, I don't know how, first it started out that, you know, you realize this radar net's not doing anything. We can't even pick up our own supply airplanes from them, let alone an invasion airplane, you know. And then we got over on the B-47s. And I says, well, we got an awful lot of those. I says, we've got them. Seems to me we've got to have about 3,000 of those. And he says, how'd you figure that? You know, I said, well, Marietta, Georgia was producing them, Wichita was producing them, and Wichita was turning out 19 of them a day.
Oh, wow.
There was two other companies who built them. And it never flew a combat mission as a bomber. They converted them into weather airplanes and recons, but they never, none of them ever dropped a bomb off. But the, anyway, and then he tried and said, well, by the way, do you know who I am? And I said, no, as a matter of fact, I don't. He says, I'm Secretary of Air Force Quarles. And this other guy, black haired guy, was up there, and this is Secretary of Defense. And I was telling him how to run their damn machinery. But then, all right. Well, we only had one bad fire up there, and that wasn't on the site that I was on. It was, and we always kept a 1D8 cat fired up and running.
Mm.
Always.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the primary fire department for serious fire.
Mm-hmm.
If you couldn't get away with doing extinguishers, you know, and the smell stuff, you're supposed to take that D8 and just take that whole second of the building and just take it out.
Uh-huh.
Because of the wind blowing up there, you never could use outside water, you know. There's just no way we could do that.
You could burn up your whole place that you're living in.
Yeah, burn the whole thing. And up there, there was no place to go, you know.
Yeah.
But that was one of my funny ones, too.
Yeah, Dad was on the dew line. How long were you on the dew line?
Not 3 years. I was 55, 56, and 57.
Did you stay there continuously?
Well, I was all over. Yeah, most of the guys went up for 18 months. You had to stay up for 9 months before you could come out, you know.
Oh, wow.
And in the fire department, to go site to site to site to do inspections like I was doing, I had to come back to the Fairbanks to get to the next site, you know.
Oh.
So I was in and out of town at least once a week, you know. It was interesting. But when the pipeline came along, I didn't want any part of it. I already had enough of that already. But I didn't need any more at all.
Dad and Uncle Earl worked on the dew line, and it was pretty hard on them.
Oh, yeah, but they had to work for 9 months before you ever get...
Yeah, I never heard about that part, that you had to stay for 9 months.
Well, it depended on some of the crafts, because you know, what they would do, get down there, and they'd have to come back in and go out to another site. They'd get back in, you know. But the primary workers per site stayed right there. They didn't move them around up there, you know. But it was transportation that some of us come back into town periodically, you know. Well, you didn't know when he was coming home either when he was up there.
Well, what he did is he went to the dew line, and first he took us to Santa Barbara, California, and then he went and worked on the dew line for 9 months or whatever it was.
Yeah.
But he only did that one winter. It was just too hard. And my Uncle Earl got real wigged out up there. It was just too hard on them mentally to be in that kind of isolation and away from
their
family.
Well, it was different.
No kidding. Yeah.
It was an interesting situation.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I'm a member of the Presbyterian Church, and I have been since I first got up here, you know, and the natives in the borough area, all that area up there, used to fly in on Navy planes, and they'd come into town, and then the people in the church go out, and then they'd stay right at the church, you know, while they were in town.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, at that time, they didn't allow any booze at all up north, you know. And so they come in, they do their buying and that kind of stuff. And then I was one of the people that took them back out to base and got them back on the plane, you know.
Mm.
And so when I went up north, I knew them all.
Oh, right.
And I was one of the few people on the new line that could go into Cap Tovey. There's a just by around. I never heard of Cap Tovey till I. All the time I was up there, I heard Bar Rye, but never heard the other name at all. But I'd go into that village, and I'd go into the barrel quite a bit. And I was out hunting with them, and all. That was an interesting thing. We shot polar bear.
Wow.
I could have had one of those hides, and I always thought, I'll get a big one.
Man, just getting one would be pretty darn big.
Well, they hunted because, you know, they used them for clothing. That's what they made their mufflers and stuff out of.
Enough. Boy, that would be very warm.
Because, like I say, I've had my interesting times in the Arctic, but then...
You had enough of them, and that was enough,
that's enough,
right?
Yeah. I've been there, done that.
Exactly. Well, I should probably get going here pretty soon.
What? Where are you?
Any more questions?
Yeah, when Bobby Miller had to move his all his stuff off of Bentley ground, you know, I took a year off and just helped Bobby. That's where I was at. That other episode happened, you know, on the heads and stuff, you know. So I just took a year off and helped Bobby. Of course, Bobby's been a good friend of mine over all these years, and I used to drive rigs up from the States for him.
I made over
100 trips over the highway, but part of the way back when it was really tough, and then later on, and I had all kinds of adventures from that one too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that old red Hilux truck, it's a 56, I think it is, that A&E Roofing used to have it, a Hilux truck. You know, I brought it up, but I had a rollback bed laid upside down on an El Camino sitting on top of that, and 4 barrels of chain. Sitting in all 4 corners, and they moved the chain around to where it balanced the load out, and I was in about 12 pounds of on each corner of being up to weight limits, you know, in my truck. And I got going into Canada, pulled in the scales, you know, and I'm like, you're overweight. And I said, you get your damn Canadian snow off of this damn truck. Then I pulled out, I weighed the truck down the States before I loaded. I had to manifest for all the stuff that was on it and all the stuff. So he took a look at all that and saw the waist strips and stuff, you know. And he says, okay, you go ahead and go, you know. And then I got up the highway. I got up to just the other side of Kalani Lake. And I was going, and this car coming toward me, you know, coming pretty good clip, you know. He caught the snowbank and went out the side, and he tried to power it, and he kept getting further away from the road. He was out about 100 feet off the road
There's
a Cadillac, and there's a military captain was rotating out of here to the States, and he had his whole family in the car, and all, you know, it was really bad, you know, and in the wintertime, snow, you know. And so, who would have had a chain that down long? Had the barrels of an uncut chain.
So there you are.
We railed all that out, and I bought hooks for them, but I could only put the hooks on one end, you know, and the other way, without having to cut the chain. And so we'd pull up, and it would be mounted on the back of the truck, and I'd pull him out and pull him again. We got him enough, finally got him back up on the road. But like I say, who else would have had a thousand?
He missed the perfect time.
So you think you need to get him back home again?
Yeah.
Within the next half hour or so.
Well, it's up to you.
Yeah.
He's got more stories, I'm sure.
We can wait a while.
If we run out of tape, we'll call it quits, but then it's still recording.
Sure.
Yeah, we can come back and do it again if some more.
Yeah.
I do recollections of a lot of this stuff, you know.
Yeah, great. You've got some great stories, Bob.
Yeah, well, I was over working on the Army pipeline, this 8-H pipeline that came from Haines.
The canal line?
Well, not the original 3-H, but you know, which George Lyle was working on, you know, early on.
Oh, yeah.
And then he was working on the 8-H line. But when he was building that, that one day, it was a real hot day in the summertime down there at Pawnee, and I Look at that leg down there. I got to touch off. I peeled off my coat and I bailed it. I don't think I even got wet. That cold hit me. And I was back on the bank and I'm bare naked.
You take a bath wherever you could.
Yeah. Well, we headed to camp, all right, you know. A little van was with an open leg. I was back hunting 2 months later, still wearing a cast, but I didn't care. But it
broke your leg?
Yeah, it rolled over, and then the door, it was an old 54 Ford, that was fitting 54 Ford on the do line. It rolled over, and then it's real slow, because I hit the ditch to keep another guy hot rodding down the middle of the road and wouldn't give me any room, and I hit the side, the road grader burned, and it caught that old Ford pickup, or the panel, or station wagon, and caught it and swung it around like this, and then rolled it. It was a steep bank, and it rolled over four times. Well, it rolled over the first roll over, the door came open, and right before seat belt, so I didn't have a seat belt.
Oh, my gosh.
And it threw me to the right hand side, and it rolled over, shut and latched the damn door on my leg.
And
hit the bed outright sideways like that.
Oh my gosh.
Of course, I was down there, I was doing first aid and safety engineers and security for the whole committee and prior to that. And the RCMP gave me a special commission so I could carry a gun. Then I set my own leg, because
you were the only person there?
Well, no, there were several people there, but I was afraid of them to touch me, so I formed up a lighter spread on my good leg, and got all padded and all that kind of stuff, and they got in there, and then I took Ace bandages, and I started at the knee, and I started working down until I got just above the break, and then I started at the toe, and wrapped it in, and pulled it all back into place.
I
went into White Horse, and Doc Tanner down there, who was the doctor at White Horse, he was, that guy was just overworked like crazy.
I'm sure.
But came in there, and he ran me right into X-ray. He said, well, it's not too bad, it's all in place. And he never did me, son.
Wow.
And you can look on X-ray today, you can see the lines all right.
Uh-huh. All back in
place. Right where it
was. Oh, my God. Any trouble after that?
Well, no. The ankle itself hurts a little bit once in a while, but you know.
Well, heck, that might have happened anyway.
But that's old age, you know.
Yeah.
What do they call that? The over 60 fall aparts? Extended?
Right.
Wow.
Now, everybody's got those.
Amen.
One way or the other, right?
Yeah.
When get me was, what's his name? The book, Street Bear?
Charlie.
Chuck Yeager.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, I met him when I was working on the 47 program down at Boyd. And my brother, this boy, was running the machine shop at the base where he when he made that speed run.
Oh, really? He made the speed run base? He left that base when he made the...
Well, he flew out of New York or one of the bases down there. I forgot where it was when he did the X-1.
Mm-hmm.
But my brother was on the machine shop, and he knew my brother. And then he got up there, and then we introduced ourselves at Boeing, and then I'd met him several times. And I went down to visit my brother when he was down there, and I'd met him again there, you know. So I'd at least been acquainted with Chuck.
Mm-hmm.
Chuck was coming up here hunting.
Mm-hmm.
And he still comes up here hunting once in a while. And he did a lot of things for the NRA, National Rifle Association.
Mm-hmm.
He did a lot of things for them, that kind of stuff. And they're always giving him plaques and this kind of crap, you know. And I had this whole Model 70 P-64 that I never used. I used my Marauder, which is a predicated that, and it's still a better rifle. But then, anyway, so that rifle was sitting there. And he was out of Two Rivers, and he always goes in out there when he comes up here. And sitting with a gang of guys, and I came in, high, and this kind of stuff. And I got to thinking, you know, I really appreciate what he does for the gun owners, you know, in the country. And so, is Chuck, you going to be here for a little while? He said, well, yeah, why? And I said, just stay here. I'll be right back. And I ran out of my house, and I got this rifle. And I gave him this damn rifle, you know.
Wow, and, that was really
so good. About 2 years later, he said, yeah, I'll put that in my collection, is what he said. And so about 2 years later, he called up and said, I'm going deer hunting. Can I use that rifle?
Well, Chuck, it's your damn life. Well, it's not mine anymore. You do you when you please, you know.
Uh-huh.
And so I haven't gotten in contact with him since then to see if he got a beer. But Jerry Ford. I had another funny one on Gerald Ford, you know, the president.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, he was still a House member, and I was driving a truck up for Bobby, incidentally, and I was in Villa, North Dakota. No, I was driving one by my own, that's right. Because I was going to pick up that new Pontiac. I thought it was in 62, I think it was. Anyway, I'd run out of money down there, and I was, you know, at that time, you had to go through Seattle and all that, and it only took about 2 or 3 days to get money down mm-hmm. you know. And, the guy that owned the little hotel in Velvet, North Dakota, who come to find out he's a staunch, hardcore right wing like I am, Republican, you know. And, mm-hmm. and so we got to talk, and he said, "Well, you want to go over to this Republican thing tonight?"
Mm-hmm.
And so we go there, and Jerry had come over there to help the other guy get elected in
mm-hmm.
North Dakota.
Mm-hmm.
And so we got, I got active around the place here, you know, doing paper folding and all the stuff that you do mm-hmm. and stuff. And finally, Jerry said, what are you doing? I said, can you come over to Michigan? Michigan? Where's that? What state are you from? And I said, I went there, but then, anyway. But he was also running for the House. Mm-hmm. And he's still in the House of Representatives, you know, mm-hmm. so it's over 2 years. And so I did it. After I got done doing what I was doing, I went up there and I helped him out in that election. Mm-hmm. And he got to know me pretty well, you know. And after he was president, he was up here and we were having that thing for him out the university, out the University Commons.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in the meeting line. I figured, what the hell, I'll go down
and
say hello, you know. And he saw me stand about eight people back in the line. He stepped out of the line, come up and said, "Bob, how you been doing?" And the people out there never did understand how I knew Jerry Ford.
That's great.
So what do you think about being footloose and fancy free? You get into it.
I know. Well, that's what I was thinking. When you're a single guy and you can just kind of flow around.
Yeah.
You've never been married?
Nope. Quite a few times I wanted to, but then...
Yeah.
They were around with me for a while, and then they take off and do something else.
Mm-hmm.
You still have a couple of sisters alive?
Three.
Three?
Yeah. I got Sylvia. Like I say, she lives in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And Pat's in Lubbock, Texas. And Mary Ellen's in Midland, Texas, in a home.
Mm-hmm.
She and her husband are both kind of lofted. Pat's still sharp, and Sylvia's still sharp. Mm-hmm. Pat's
not a bad percentage.
Pat's 80, and Mary Ellen's 83, and Sylvia is 76, I guess. She's born 34, whatever that does.
Yeah, 76.
Yeah. Sylvia's married to a retired colonel. She married military. But her first husband was doing parabolics in the space program in one of the jet airplanes. Anyway, doing mm-hmm. weightless things, you know. And they crashed the airplane and killed him. And then so then old gal, buddy of mine, was a nurse up here. And she was a captain when I first met her, and we hadn't kept in contact for a whole lot of years. And so one of the other neighbors up here, a sister, was wanting to go into military nursing, you know. And so she got a bunch of letters, and she sent some up to him to read and see what he thought, you know. And I looked at her, and here's Irene Went.
Irene Went? She married the
Went? No. So, Irene is the nurse out the base out
mm-hmm.
here when I broke this arm.
Mm-hmm.
And we got to be real good friends. And anyway, here's Irene. She's a bird colonel, but now, you know, she's head of nurse recruiting for the whole Air Force. So, I noted that, and I said, well, I know she's down. Well, after Pat's husband got killed, I went down about 2 months later to see if I could help out and that kind of stuff. And or Sylvia, and it got kind of funny because I knew Irene was in town, you know, so I called her up first. It was kind of funny because back when the military out here, I had owned an ambulance, a surplus ambulance, mm-hmm. and we had it on contract up at Murphy Bowl. And I was still in the military, but a kid named Perry Roden was running for me up there. You know, he used to bring it in once a week, and we'd mm-hmm. gas it up. We'd go to the gas station on the base and make about 12 cents a gallon or 6 cents or whatever it was.
Oh, my gosh.
Anyway, this one day, he comes in, and he picked me up, and my arm was in a cast, and he found stuff, but I was driving the ambulance, and we drove out right the corner, and here's Irene, and her name, they called her Alabama. The other nurse, and anyway, they were standing in the corner in uniform, you know, mm-hmm. and so they flagged the ambulance down, you know, so it stopped, she looked at her, well, what are you doing? I said, well, it's a private, we're going to town, that's what you want, you know, and then she, you know, so she climbed in, and then I pulled up to the pay gas station, and we couldn't have made it to town without gas,
mm-hmm.
it was closed.
Uh-huh.
I said, okay. So I just pulled across the road over to the issue station, and I gassed the whole thing up, you know, and scribbled out a number, and you know, and the only difference between my ambulance and the other ones was mine didn't have a number card anymore. And it did have license plate.
Uh-huh.
And anyway, when I called her, when she's up at Wright Pat, I called her on the phone and I got her secretary first, you know, and then the mm-hmm. secretary, well, she's not in right now, you know, come take a message. No, I'll call back later. Later on, I called back, and Irene picked up the phone, and she, you know, crawled in, the old mm-hmm. proper thing, you know, and I said, have you helped steal any gas lately? Dead silence for about a minute and a half. Bob? Fun things.
yeah, for sure.
But the power plant on the base out there, when he caught on fire, it was after I was out of service, and I was at Hamill Acres, and I heard they had the fire. No, I was still civil defense, I think, at that time. Anyway, I'm in charge now there because I knew they were always short-handed on serious fires, and I went out there, and the two senior NCOs in the department were still there from when I'd been in.
Mm-hmm.
And I had gone, we were sitting in a critique one time, and I said, well, there's a Navy, I had a Navy manual, you know, and it described what they call wet water. It's a detergent you put in the water to lower the surface tension of the water, make mm-hmm. it penetrate better. And we never had any out to the base, never had any. Never had any smoke masks or any of that kind of crap. But anyway, and then, somewhere, I discovered the Tide soap. It was primarily trisodium phosphate,
mm-hmm.
which is the same thing what water is.
Mm-hmm.
And we were critiqued. I said, well, if we ever get a serious fire, we need penetration. I said, well, I'll just go over to the Great Bridge Commissary and mix up my booster tanks and get it done. Well, I came over there, you know, and here's this fire going on.
Very serious fire.
What was his name? One of the best crash guys I ever met, the crash firefighter's name was Bailey. I walked up and he looked over and said, well, shall we do it? He asked me, shall we do it?
Really?
And the whole power plant was right by the commissary
uh-huh.
on the base.
So
it was really easy. We all broke in the back door and stole all our soap and went out and started mixing the tanks, and that's what put the fire out.
Wow.
And that was right after that I was working in the coal because they still had real spot stuff going on in the coal bunks
uh-huh.
up above. And so they lost one boiler, so they tied in four Alaska Railroad engines, all tied into one header, and just feeding that into the power plant to keep that base from freezing up completely.
Mm.
mm. But it was that's when I was in the coal room when those guys from Boeing came in. That was the B-47.
Mm. mm-hmm.
I should be able to remember the dates, but I can't.
Oh, it's hard. It's easy to remember the situation, but
yeah. Well, it can be tied together because you look in the newspaper to find out who the base power plant burnt.
Right.
It's like the power plant on the base out there right now. They're always having coal bin fires.
There's
only one. Yeah, and they burned up the whole system on one end down there a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And the only reason he could ever, ever, ever do that is because people are not keeping it clean.
Because there's so much.
All they got to do is go in there, remember, once a day and wash all the coal dust out there, and that ends the problem.
Mm.
And they're not doing it.
Mm.
Bunch of damn civil service workers that draw and pay and not doing their damn job. I mean, of course, I quite frankly think everybody in civil service should take at least a 30% reduction in pay.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody. Well, no. Take the ones that are down to 40,000 and less. No. All right.
Mm-hmm.
But the ones above that level, you bet.
Mm-hmm.
Absolute 20% reduction in grade. They're getting 71% more money than the same job out in the private market.
Mm-hmm.
71%!
Mm-hmm.
For the same job.
Yeah, I don't know anything about it.
That's what the Democrats do for the country. The only difference between a Democrat and a socialist and a communist is a little bit of method. The end result's the same. The total wrecking of the Republican.
I'll bet you, Fabian, I don't want your Fabian file on that.
No, Fabian, well, they've moved because the road now comes down on the east side of his place, doesn't it?
I think Fabian is.
Unless he is
no longer. No, hey,
there's less left. This
yeah,
is
where
yeah, there,
no,
there,
now,
there
no,
we go. Yeah,
oh,
that's,
yeah,
that's
yeah,
more like
yeah.
It.
Well, I mean, Rod got that bill. He went to the legislatures and everybody else. Of course, he's a good Democrat, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He can get all those stinking Democrats to do things for him. Which you understand my thought, at least. But anyway.
Democrat, too.
Well, that's all right. The Lord will forgive you down the road.
That
got built, and Les Loudon got it built, and then they named it Bennett Road.
Oh, he was probably pissed about that, huh?
Well,
after all that.
His son was.
Yeah.
That's right. There's the Fabians and then the Farkases.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is, those, Loudon had the roots out just below the road.
Right.
And,
mm-hmm.
They went out in front of that. There was a big peat bog.
Oh.
We had this old 6x, which I built the engine for logs, and we were digging peat and selling it in town.
Mm.
And we dug all the peat right down the middle of earth under that out and dried it out.
Wow.
And we did that on the ankles. I think there were three of those peat bogs that we dug out of the ground and sold and then filled them in and made good ground out of them.
Yeah, wow.
Filled them in with what?
It was a dump bed on, you know. We load up, load the dump truck and haul into town, you know.
Now, where were you getting the soil, though?
To fill it in. You said you filled it.
From sideways.
Okay, yeah. Just topsoil, whatever. Was.
Yeah.
Okay.
He's over there.
Oh, there's another question.
That dried all that ground out.
Yeah. Who was buying peat?
Oh, everybody in town. I mean,
for gardening? For what?
What's his name? The old coal park for wheat? At Cliff Edwards?
Yeah.
We did it all around his house, and he put about 4 inches of peat on that, and that's still got a good long hanging in there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting that people were paying money for peat at that time.
Well, you had to haul it in, you know.
Well, sure. Well, I understand there being a charge for it, but I'm just surprised that people had the money and interest and all to do it.
Cliff Edwards always did have, you know.
Yeah.
I still don't know where he's been on all those cars today. He goes to every car on commission, he buys a whole bunch of them, you know.
Hmm.
He's got his Cliff air fuel.
Every air, right?
Air,
yeah.
And all that, you know.
So Loud's actually, their house is on this little triangle, huh? Yes. Or is it up here? Yeah,
the house is right in that corner.
Okay. And then that building that we see, that log house with all the machinery and stuff, that's over here.
Yeah, that's right, where the old root cellar. That's where the old root cellar was.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. Where the shop
mm-hmm.
is there. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, that first year that I homesteaded, I tried to get some seed potatoes to plant on the ground,
mm-hmm.
and I couldn't find them, you know, white, most of the spreads that they raised up there, and I got white bliss, and it was a good year, and I made a phenomenal production rate on the
mm-hmm.
white bliss,
mm-hmm.
and then I went the route to the co-op, and I'd already signed an agreement with them, you know, both storage and application for membership, you know, and
And he told me I could store potatoes there. Well, then when I got all these damn potatoes, they said, well, everybody else in town had a good potato year too, you know. So they wouldn't let me in there. Well, then I went up to the man, what was his name up on, right up, what was his name, the preacher.
Fitz.
Fitz, Doc Fitz.
Yeah.
I went up to Doc Fitz, had some space, and I had to get,
in his
60 ton of potatoes, didn't it?
Wow.
So then I went back to the co-op, because they'd already signed a marketing agreement. Well, we got to let our members, reported members, get out first.
First, uh-huh.
And I went to town, and I went in, and I saw Earl Hausman.
Mm-hmm.
Wiggly.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I went in the center of Earl's. I said, Earl, can you buy some potatoes? You know, I bought seed and fertilizer stuff, and I was really short. You're really short of money then.
Mm-hmm.
And Earl says, well, can you bring some in and show them to me? And I brought him 100 pounds. That was when you saw the bins. You just dumped in the bins.
Oh, okay. I don't remember.
And so. I came in, we dumped out, and he said, well, these are good-looking potatoes. You know, he says, how soon can you get 15 ton in here?
Right now.
Well, I hired a couple of kids, and we went out there and bagged up and got that in, and
uh-huh.
And he sold that whole 60 ton out in less than a month.
Wow. Now,
he just sold them for, he sold them for 10 or 11 cents a pound, and he was giving me 9.
Wow.
And right after that, all these guys got the ballot over selling their potatoes.
Uh-huh.
They got double less than 2.5 cents a pound.
The people in the co-op.
Yeah.
Well, that was Gettinger and
uh-huh. You, it sounds like you beat everything to the punch.
No, I got it over house.
Yeah.
And that was the best grocery store in town at that time.
Yeah.
That was on 2nd Avenue, right?
Yeah,
I remember that very
Piggly
vaguely.
Wiggly on 2nd Avenue, mm-hmm. Before the round building? Before it went in the round door?
Well, where the alley goes through between...
Yeah, Blanchfield Alley, it was called.
Yeah, and Piggly had a side loading deal down at the basement.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
It's about where probably the parking lot for the hotel is now.
That's pretty good.
Right
in there.
Building's
long gone.
Oh, for the Marriott?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Did you grow anything else besides potatoes on your homestead?
After that potato war, I decided, you know, this is silly, because by that time, everybody was selling their potatoes for 2.5-3 cents.
That's a lot of work.
And you can't make any money at that.
Right.
And so I said, well, heck with that. So I went into hay and grain.
Okay. So were you supplying a lot of the horse people in town?
Yeah. Well, mm-hmm. I was
How many horse people were there in those days? Horses weren't that common.
Oh, yeah. Even back then, there was over 2,000 headed horses in the area.
Is that right?
Wow.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
And later on, got up to over 3.
Well, I had no idea there were that many. I would have thought...
No, not, you know, there for a while, I had four of them.
Okay.
I had two, and then I had two other people's horses with me.
I would have thought it was pretty expensive to keep a horse in those days, and
it
still is.
Because later on, it was a neighbor's horse who was running with mine, and it got Carl Wilson out of Springs. Hit that horse, and the next day Carl had a heart attack and died. And Carl was a real good friend of mine. I used to go up there. The reason I used to be running mm-hmm. his jeeps and all kinds of stuff to get up there, you know, he and Bob, they were real good friends of mine. And
Yeah.
Oh, horse one hit maybe my horse heard children, you know.
How come his horse was out on the road?